Hello and welcome to Charity Pulse, your bi-weekly dive into the heart of the charity sector. Remember, so you don't miss future episodes, be sure to hit the follow button on whichever streaming platform you are listening on. I'm Catherine Rastomji, partner and head of charities at Shakespeare Martineau, and I am joined today by Charles Mosquita, charities director at Quilterceviot, and James Saunders, partner at Morkingston Smith. Together, we explore the latest insights and pressing issues affecting charities, non-profit organisations and the voluntary sector. Whether you're a charity professional, a passionate volunteer or simply someone who cares about making a difference, there's something here for you. So grab your headphones and get ready to engage with the vital conversations shaping the future of the charity landscape. And don't forget, you can catch us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and YouTube, as well as on our own websites. So let's get started. So we've seen in a previous session that the first communication from the new chief executive of the Charity Commission, David Holdsworth, was to all local authorities in the UK. And what we've had this week is the first official warning that has ever been issued to a local authority by the Charity Commission. That local authority is Calderdale, which many people might not know, but that's sort of West Yorkshire area. And it related to 13 charities of which they are a trustee. So I just wondered your thoughts and observations on that first official warning having been issued. Charles, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I suppose that having had the letter and then the warning coming quite so quickly after the letter from the chief executive, from memory, reading the warning, a lot of it was about not completing their report and accounts and still being in dereliction. I think there's a bigger issue here around what I call quasi-government. So I think the NHS might fall into this. And when they have charities and understanding the conflicts of interest and their legal duties as far as that. So I suspect this might well go further. And I suspect there may be some stuff around particularly charity land that may not be being used for what it was effectively gifted for in the original thing. And I suspect a lot of these charities come out of what I call the Victorian era, where they've been sort of local community funds set up that have come under the auspices of a local authority. In my mind, I don't know, when I've looked at these, and again, not looked at them in any great detail, I wonder whether they should really be sitting within the local authorities at all and shouldn't just be separate charities, but maybe they're too small to be moved out. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And James, I don't know your thoughts, but the local authority had been issued with an action plan in 2023, and it sounds as though they have not done very much, if anything at all, to progress that action plan. And I did wonder if this is the commission maybe flexing its muscles a bit to say, look, we're not going to treat you more lightly than we would any other charity trustee.
It does sound like that, doesn't it? And perhaps as I think we mentioned last time, perhaps it's not just flexing their muscles in this particular case, but for a sector that they might be targeting for whatever reason. Perhaps it does seem a strange coincidence that this was a flagged for them, and they're now the first official warning to a local authority is coming out. So, yeah, I think on both fronts, it does seem to be they want to make an example, but they want to be strong with this particular organisation, and it possibly signals that there might be a few more of these to come.
Yeah, I do wonder whether that's going to be a trend. I suppose moving on to another trend that we're seeing this week, this is new research from Pro Bono Economics, all to do with philanthropy, but particularly focusing on wealthy British donors. And I did wonder if I was just micro reading the article and picking out wording, but it talked about of the 86% that give to charity, one in six could double their donation. That's my emphasis added there, very much could, but there does seem to be quite a focus here on philanthropic giving. How do we increase it? And is there a kind of untapped resource here that we're not getting access to? So James, I'll come to you first this time. You know, I wonder in the world of philanthropy what your experiences are or what you made of this particular story.
Yeah, it did seem a bit of a strange set of statistics and opinion poll responses. I think your point, Catherine, about could double their donations, that was a, you know, an element, that was a, an opinion poll response. So, you know, I'm sure people are very honest when they complete these things, but how representative that is of most people, I don't know. There is definitely more money that could be gleaned from these sort of sources. The tax relief systems are tricky, and many. I mean, there's many different ways of getting money to charities, all sorts of different relief schemes. And it is complex. It is complex to understand quite how the best way to get your money to charities. You know, if you want to be really clever about it, then there's definitely ways and means. If you want to just give money straight to charity, I mean, even charities themselves have regular gift aid schemes, and then a small donation scheme as well, which I would say from experience is underused. And I think that's probably reflected in the stats in this report, that it's actually quite a small part really of the overall gift aid tax relief package. So it's very, very convoluted and complex to understand quite what's going on with all of these different schemes. There's loads and loads, and it is complex.
And I think that does lead on as well, doesn't it? There's another story about wealth advisors lacking confidence in steering clients towards legacy giving. And I suppose, again, that piece, Charles, looking at you more so here, of there isn't that wealth of understanding of how charities work and, you know, how you could support charities. And I suppose, again, you know, whose role is that to educate others, and how do we get that message out there?
I mean, I know there has been some representation from the sector, both to Treasury and to the FCA, about making it as part of the educational programme. And to my mind, that makes complete sense, and probably we should, because it actually, when everybody's looking at I suppose, at their will, doing a will, that's probably the time they should be thinking about whether they want to give money to charity. Again, I think this is always a difficult issue, isn't it? Because although Lando Fraser was also, I think last year, was quite vocal around philanthropy and encouraging people to give more money. And the figure that was in that article was about 2.8 billion, I think, or 2.3 billion additional money that could end up with charities. It is definitely very complex. One of the way that the taxation situation works with givers you earn, and how people reclaim that tax back. But generally, people aren't doing it from a tax point of view. I mean, obviously, you want to be tax efficient on it. I think it's more about how the sector communicates to people about the benefits of what they can do. If they should so choose to, because taxation is that we have to pay and there's no choice, and it covers the welfare state. Philanthropy is very much so a decision for the individual to make on whatever area they feel passionate about, whether they want to do it or not. So I think there's definitely education would be a really helpful thing. I think people being shown the opportunity and how easy it can be, and possibly charities looking about how they should engage with large donors and the communication around that of keeping them involved in the impact of the money that they've given.
Interesting, isn't it? And James, that links into we've had some statistics this week about UK charity tax relief generally, and how that is broken down between the different tax reliefs and the amount that's being claimed. It's a complicated read just to see the summary of the statistics. What do you think generally in terms of the gift aid regime and how, you know, tax efficient giving to charity is or isn't being taken up?
It seems to be pretty steady as you go, really. There's a few, you know, minor ups and downs in the trends, but generally speaking, the figures are comparable to previous years. But as we said, there's multiple different elements to these tax reliefs now, and I mean, it's worth saying that, you know, the last Conservative, the tail end of the Conservative government, did have a commitment to look at gift aid and tax and charity tax reliefs in general. There was the consultation that we've spoken about previously from HMRC about it, albeit, if you remember, the focus tended to be on fraud in the gift aid system rather than making it work more effectively. I think of the five questions, four of them were about, you know, dodgy elements of or dodgy use of the gift aid, and one was about how to make it more attractive, if memory serves. That Give As You Earn in particular that Charles mentioned, again, I think personally, sadly underused. And I think part of the reason is, two parts of the reason are, A, it is complex to understand and really see the benefit to you personally of giving through the payroll rather than just giving money to charity. You know, the gift aid still applies. Okay, you save a bit of tax, but, you know, it's quite difficult to get it all organized. It takes a lot of effort. You know, you've got to commit to it for a certain amount of time. It, you know, in theory, you don't want to change your pay every month. But also, you know, is there a real benefit to you in giving through a Give As You Earn scheme? It's not quite clear how much you personally benefit other than saving the tax. So, and you can claim it back anyway. So I would have thought the Give As You Earn would be a much better better applied scheme if there was more benefit to all parties. And I think I could see benefits in all the admin side for all parties in doing it that way. You know, I can see a much better way of it being used personally.
Interesting. And it's, I think, a theme this week that we're seeing different stories come around that we have touched on before. And another one that has been reported in the press was a bank apologising for an error in a debanking letter that was sent to a Holocaust education charity. And the bank said it was an algorithm-based standard form of letter. I don't think anyone disputes that. I think some of our clients have definitely received these algorithm-based letters. My issue would be, was it issued to that charity client of theirs by mistake? Or is the mistake now that that has been picked up in the press and it doesn't look great for the bank involved? But I wondered your thoughts on this story, but also just in general, the challenge for charities that are facing this issue of possible debanking and the Charity Commission and what they've tried to do in relation to it. So to be fair, I'll go to Charles first this time.
Yeah, I mean, we did have Helen Stevenson talking about it about 6-9 months ago, and they were going to go and talk to or they have been in conversation with banks and the FCA and everything else. I must admit, I have some sympathy with the banks, because it is, you know, there is a certain amount of complexity that comes around with charities. But also, I think they don't make it particularly easy as well. It just seems fundamentally wrong that charities shouldn't be able to open bank accounts. But we've also we need to give them some latitude, particularly those charities that are operating overseas, because that also comes with a whole lot of complexity, of which, you know, from a bank's point of view, if something goes wrong, actually it's their reputation that is then put at risk, and of course they have much deeper pockets. So if there's recompense being looked for, then the bank is going to be the one that's asked for it. So I can sort of understand from their perspective why they might have a reluctance to do it. I don't know about on the AI thing. And just one thing, just go back just on the HMRC's report. The other thing that always slightly amuses me, and perhaps I'm misreading this, is that they seem to be always portraying they're doing a favour to the sector for giving the tax back rather than taking it. And you do slightly fundamentally think that actually charities shouldn't be paying tax, because they are actually there for the public benefit and doing good. You know, so I just, sorry, just to pick up on some of the things that James was covering earlier.
And James, debanking, are you seeing that with some of your clients?
Yeah, loads. I mean, we've mentioned this before, that I think is terrible. I have no sympathy with the banks. I'm sorry, Charles. I have to do anti-money laundering checks for new clients. Solicitors, lawyers have to do anti-money laundering checks for clients. I don't write to the bank and say, right, I can't be bothered to do it. I'm just going to get you to write and verify everything for me, which is what they do to us, you know, regularly. You know, they just don't, they're not prepared to try and understand the charity sector. And if it's not a company limited by shares and you can't verify the ownership, they just throw their hands up and say, right, well, we'll just get the accountants or the lawyers to do it. You know, they've got to be better than that. And I think they are being held to account now. It does seem the attention's getting in there, but it hasn't changed the fact that I've had plenty of clients who have, you know, a couple who have just had their accounts summarily closed and a check written to them. And as I've mentioned before, what that does mean is you're pretty much blackballed by every other bank. The moment you say to a bank, you know, we would like to open an account because and as you have to, so and so closed ours and didn't want to deal with us, you know, the odds are set against you. And other charities, you know, I've got a Royal Charter charity trying to set up a bank account, completely no hope whatsoever. I mean, something about, you know, the bank insisted on wet signatures rather than e-signatures or something, and therefore cancel the application. It's just absurd. You know, they don't seem to want to work with charities, seems to be the gist of things. So, yeah, sorry, that's a bit of a rant.
No, I have some sympathy as well around everybody's interpretation of the anti-money laundering regulations is different. So whether you can have wet signatures, whether all trustees have to sign, only some have to sign and everything else. And there's a real inconsistency there. And I'm not an expert in this area, but I do think that the FCA could probably put a little bit of guidance around that of what is needed and acceptable. But I suspect they don't, because they don't want to then find themselves that somebody got it wrong.
The bit of sympathy I do have with the banks is that they did get fined. They have been fined huge amounts of money for, you know, what I think, as we've covered this before, you know, what seemed to be reasonably minor contraventions of the AML regulations. So the disproportionate nature of how much they've been fined probably leads to this overreaction on their own AML procedures.
I'm not sure they have been fined for minor. That I think we need to be careful about making that statement, because I think the regulators look at these things pretty carefully, and there is certainly, again, we only hear it from the press, so we're not looking at it obviously at integral detail, but certainly some of the behaviours of some of the banks have been somewhat surprising, that they thought that was acceptable in any shape or form.
Yeah, I just find it interesting. I think it's the status of charities as a client for the banks, that when they're looking for deposits, they're all over charities like a rash. And then when they actually are being asked to provide banking in a traditional banking sense, they don't want to do that because they're not making sufficient profit on that transaction. So I do think cynically, it is, you know, reaction in the market. But I also wonder whether that's an opportunity for the third sector banks to say, we're moving into this space and we're gaining more traction in it, which is competition for the high street banks maybe. But I am going to close things off here because I think we are pretty much at time. So thank you for tuning in to this episode of Charity Pulse. We hope you found our discussion insightful. If you have any questions or topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes, we'd love to hear from you. Don't forget to follow us, leave a review and share our podcast with your network. Join us next time as we continue to explore the challenges and opportunities facing charities, nonprofits and voluntary organisations. Until then, keep the pulse of charity beating strong.